This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the PFL in Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to Robert Kreese about the new book, The Leak: Politics, Activists, and Loss of Trust at Brookhaven National Laboratory. How the discovery of a harmless leak of radiation sparked a media firestorm, political grandstanding, and fear-mongering that closed a vital scientific facility. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Galina. I'm very happy to have the chance to talk about the book. You know, my head has been so full of writing the book for so long. Now I can talk to someone about it.
So, can you introduce yourself? What do you do?
Well, my name is Robert Kreese. I'm a professor of philosophy at Stony Brook University. I'm actually the chair of the department. And I work on the history and philosophy of science. And I started, you know, I went to graduate school to study philosophy at Columbia. And while I was a grad student, a friend of mine, my college roommate, and I started writing articles about various scientific episodes in the vicinity. Do you happen to know Charles Mann? He wrote 1491 and 1493. He's a pretty well known author right now. But he and I started, as I said, he was my college roommate. He and I started writing about scientific facilities. And when I became a philosopher at Stony Brook, I began to see that the things that philosophers of science were studying about science really had little to do with how it was actually practiced. That is, philosophers of science studied things like, logical things, relation between theory and evidence, the development of theories, and so forth. But what it was like for scientists to work in a social environment was something that they very rarely wrote about. So that's something I became interested in. And I also began writing the history of Brookhaven National Laboratory. Maybe we'll get to more of the history, but it was founded in 1947, right after World War II. And I wrote a book about the history of its first 25 years. And just at the tail end of it, this episode happened that is what I wrote about in The Leak. And it was just an amazing episode for me. In fact, I couldn't quite believe what was happening. And at the time, I was thinking of writing about it, but I thought that nobody would believe what was happening. And so I didn't write about it for 25 years. And suddenly it becomes, what happened has become very current.
And in your career, have you ever been tempted to become a scientist yourself?
Not really. I just have so much fun writing about it. I mean, I guess, you know, philosophers like to stick their nose into other people's business and, you know, find out about other fields and so forth and learn how they work and compare and contrast them. And I like doing that. So, no, I'm not tempted to become a scientist. I just want to study it.
And in your career journey, did you have mentors that really inspired and supported you?
There were a few. I mean, there was a philosopher. There were some philosophers who did philosophy of science, but of the sort that I'm interested in, but not quite. But no, I thought I was really doing in focusing on how science really works in a social environment. I was pretty much, I think, doing something original.
And as a mentor yourself, what would you say to our student listeners and perhaps philosophers who are considering studying philosophy of science?
I'd say try to write about it. Try to write short articles about what you see, because those will teach you how to study, how to do research, how to talk to people, and so forth. I mean, I am I've been writing a column for a physics magazine for almost 23 years now. It's called Critical Point, and it's about historical and philosophical and sociological dimensions of sometimes artistic dimensions of physics. And I have a limit. It's 950 words. And the editor goes over it. And every time I use jargon, he says, nope, you got to cut that, rewrite it. And that's taught me a lot. It taught me a lot how to express, how to develop ideas that are important enough to write about and will interest people, but that you can say concisely enough in 950 words, that is one page. So I get my advice is, want to write about anything? Well, practice.
So your latest book that you wrote together with your co-author, Peter Bond, is The Leak, Politics, Activists, and Loss of Trust at Brookhaven National Laboratory. So how did your collaboration with Peter come about?
Well, as I said, at the time it was happening, I thought maybe I wanted to write about this, but it was, but I didn't think people would believe the story. It was so incredible. It was so implausible. But I collected material. And Peter, who was actually at the lab at the time, thought that it was an important story, and he collected some material. Now, he's not a writer. He was a scientist himself, but he kept pushing me. Every once in a while, I'd say, Pop, you ought to write about this. And finally, at the beginning of the pandemic, I thought, or just before it started, he and I started working together. And you know, the book is literally with him. I wrote it with him. But he would find documents for me. He would arrange contacts with people. He would, every time I wrote something, he would go over it with a fine-toothed comb. And he was incredibly patient, incredibly insightful. Every time I'd say something sloppily or maybe too emotionally or something, he would point it out. And so it was really a wonderful collaboration. And we started out, as I said, just before the pandemic, and I would go over to his house and we would go over the events week by week, month by month, and I'd take notes and I would go home and write it and send it to him. And then the pandemic started and we would Zoom together once or twice a week. And slowly we pieced the story together.
Okay, so let's jump right in. And can we start with sort of general profile of the decade and the year of 1997? So what was happening in the world?
In the 1990s, mm-hmm. Well, there was an increased, what sort of thing do you mean? You mean general events or scientific events? What's, what are you getting at?
So put us in that decade, because nowadays, for example, going through pandemic, world has changed. So we don't really know what kind of things were happening. So were there smartphones? Was there communication globally or...
Ah, that's interesting. No, there weren't. It was kind of a different environment. This was before social media, so you know, information circulated through newspapers, headlines for newspapers. If people found something, people, and this was important for the story. If people knew about the lab, it was mostly through headlines. You know, not even the story, perhaps, but Brookhaven was building a. Let me talk just a little bit about Brookhaven before I answer that. Brookhaven, as I said, was founded in 1947, first of the one of the first national laboratories. And the reason national laboratories were built was to build instruments that were too big a scale for individual universities or industries to afford. And most of them were such as, in particular, reactors and accelerators. These were, you know, individual universities' science departments couldn't afford them. So Brookhaven then built several generations of these instruments of reactors and accelerators. And I should say, when they by reactors, I mean research reactors, because it's very important to distinguish between two kinds of reactors. One is power reactors that are designed to produce electricity, and those are huge. And then there's research reactors, which are comparatively, which are much smaller, and they're designed to do scientific research. And it's really, you need to understand the difference, because you know, in power reactors produce two things, neutrons and heat. And in power reactors, you keep the heat and turn it into energy, and you throw away the neutrons. In research reactors, you throw away the heat and use the neutrons for research. Neutrons are used for studying, you know, structures of materials. And this was important in the day because superconductivity had just been discovered, and you needed neutrons to understand the material structure. They use it for imaging, biological imaging. They use it for making cancer diagnoses and cures, and for producing medical isotopes for health reasons. And so that's what the second generation of research reactors at Brookhaven. The second generation reactor was called the high flux beam reactor that produced a lot of neutrons. Completed 1965, and it ran you know safely for over 30 years. It did a lot of very valuable scientific research. But to get to the 1990s, as you said, by that time, there were increasing concerns about reactors. I mean, reactors are symbolically very loaded. They're the sign of at the time they were the sign of the future. They were symbolic of the future and of scientific progress. But increasingly, they also became associated with fear. They became, you know, magnets for fear, especially after certain episodes like Three Mile Island, 1979, Chernobyl, 1986. So there was elevated concerns about the safety of nuclear reactors. Now, again, these were mainly, these were about not research reactors, but about power reactors, but it was easy to transfer the fear from from one to the other. So you asked about what else was different about the 90s. Well, there was, as I said, no social media. You learn from headlines. A number of other things that are you thinking of anything in particular?
No, that actually completely answers my question, because many of our listeners are going to be a little bit younger, so they would not really understand what kind of decade we're talking about. So with the Brookhaven National Laboratory, who worked there? What kind of people were there? Were there physicists, contractors, or can you go there with your own project?
That is an interesting question, because that's an important part of Brookhaven. Brookhaven, as a national laboratory, it was built to study all kinds of basic research. That is not a military laboratory. It was for basic research. And so there were physicists who were studying at the time. They were building a machine to study the early universe, you know, and quark, gluon, plasma, and the universe as it was just a few seconds after the Big Bang. There were chemists. There was a huge medical and biological program to develop imaging methods. The first PET scanner had been built early on at Brookhaven, and Brookhaven had pioneered the use of a lot of medical imaging isotopes. There was an engineering department. There was, as I said, there was a medical department. So it was basic research that people at universities from all over the country and all over the world would use. So again, not military. It's it was open to scientific researchers from everywhere.
Okay, so do we need to know anything else from the background before we come to the main event that is the title of your book, The Leak?
Don't think so. It's what happens next is what the book is all about.
Yep, that's the juiciest part. Okay, so what happened? What do you refer to? What is the leak?
Well, it's the book is about how a non-hazardous leak led to the closure of a major scientific facility, that is the high-flux beam reactor, and nearly of the laboratory itself. So non-hazardous leak dropped into this highly sensitive, hypercharged environment, and it closed the reactor and nearly the lab itself. And it's an early case of science denial. I mean, it was the canary in the coal mine, you might say, for a lot of what we see around us. Conspiracy theories, science denial, politicians believing celebrities becoming politicians, and people evaluating whether scientific results are true or not based upon the political implications, only the political implications, and so on. And as I said, at the time, I just couldn't believe that this was happening. But I see it all around us now, and it's important to tell this story.
Okay, so what happened? What was the sort of technical part of the incident? What do we know?
The technical part was, you know, the you have the reactor itself, which is run by uranium fuel elements. And when the uranium fuel elements are spent, when they're, you know, used up, you take them and you put them in a nearby pool of water. And that's called a spent fuel, let's call it the spent fuel vessel. And when in the spent fuel vessel, because they are these fuel elements are radioactive, they turn some of the water into tritium, which is an isotope of hydrogen, which is radioactive, but it's very, well, lightly radioactive, meaning the radioactivity can be stopped by a single piece of paper. And it has a half-life of 12.3 years, meaning that it gradually decays and eventually vanishes. And it's, you know, a relatively innocuous kind of radioactivity. It's used in self-eliminating exit signs, for instance. I mean, you know, the exit signs, these were put in a lot of federal buildings right after the World Trade Center bombing. The self-eliminating exit signs They're geophysicists, hydrogeologists put tritium in the ground to monitor ground flow. They're used in self-eliminating watches and so forth. So it's used a lot, but it was the material in this spent fuel vessel. And the leak was that the spent fuel vessel began to leak tritium, and that this was discovered at the end of 1996, and it was announced at the beginning of 1997 after the readings were confirmed. And it was that announcement that created the firestorm that the book is all about. Now, I should say, let me say that the lab was not entirely innocent. They should have discovered this leak beforehand. It had been leaking for 12 years. So that's a big element in you know, the loss of trust at the lab. If the scientists could not said that it wasn't leaking, and then they discover a leak, if they're mistaken about that, what else could they be mistaken about? So but it was that the book is about the technical aspect is about that leak, the leak of tritium and its discovery.
Yeah, because tritium is the same as heavy water. We can call it heavy water, isn't it? And we've got plenty of deposits around. So from technical point of view, we already knew that this is quite, not maybe innocuous, but not hazardous.
Well, not quite heavy water. I mean, heavy water, you know, ordinary hydrogen has one proton in the nucleus. Heavy water has a proton and a neutron, and it's not radioactive. And it's used in reactors to heavy water is used to moderate or slow down the neutrons. Tritium is with a proton and two neutrons in the nucleus. So it's you know, if you take ordinary hydrogen, you add one neutron, that's heavy water, not radioactive. Two neutrons, it's tritium, and it does this soft, it's called a soft beta emitter, meaning it's this soft form of radiation. But as hydrogen, it combines with water. So it acts in the ground just like water. You put it in the water and it moves with the water, it combines with the water, that sort of thing. So it's a second isotope, well, third actually, beside the original hydrogen. So hydrogen, deuterium, which makes heavy water, and tritium.
Aha, gotcha. So then let's turn to the reactions. So we can have different levels as well where people reacted at. So starting with maybe scientists and technicians, and what was going on in the field? How did they react to it?
Well, again, that's interesting. And one of the interesting things about the book that I was quite enthralled to find was to see was that the different reactions from different groups of people. The scientific community sort of said, ho hum, tritium isn't dangerous. The leak was not getting into drinking water, either at the lab or beyond the borders of the lab. It was gonna decay. It was above the drinking water standards, but those were so low that it was safe to drink. So the scientific community thought, you know, big deal. We'll stop the leak, and that'll be fine. The environmental scientists at the lab said, wait a minute, how come we didn't spot the leak for a dozen years? And so they were concerned about how this reactor that had been designed so safely could, how come there could be this like literal hole in the plans. The politicians was another group. There was, you know, the political climate at the around the lab. You know, we're talking about Long Island and the easternmost tip of Long Island called Suffolk County, and the local senator and congressman were going to be facing tough re-election campaigns. They were conservative Republicans who didn't have many environmental credentials. In fact, Senator Alphonse D'Amato had literally zero environmental credentials. The League of Conservation Voters gave him a rating of 0% out of, 100. And they jumped on this leak in order to show how concerned about the environment that they were. So the reaction from politicians was that they attacked the lab for having missed this leak for so long. The local anti-nuclear activists also this riveted their attention because it was a leak. You know, it wasn't technically a leak from the reactor; it was a leak from the spent fuel pool. But nevertheless, they were the local anti-nuclear activists seized upon it as a possible reason to shut the reactor. And then the media, of course, loved it because the media could compare it to Chernobyl, or illegitimately, but they could compare it to Chernobyl or Three Mile Island. They could run, the local tabloids could run pictures of skeletons and atomic explosions and so forth. So you had, meanwhile, the Department of Energy, who owned the laboratory, was concerned because the Department of Energy ran many scientific facilities throughout the country. And every time there was a problem at one of them, they feared for their reputation. Mm. So you have all these groups, and even in the local community, you have some people who live near the lab and who dialogue with the lab, and you have other people who were afraid of the laboratory. You have all these groups with different kinds of attitudes towards what was happening. And here you drop in this announcement of this leak, and it created this maelstrom.
So what was the immediate aftermath for the laboratory? Was it shut?
Well, no, it was a long, drawn out, I keep saying this, but it's true. It's that there's an unfolding story, which my book, The Leak, is about. The leak is announced mid-January. Politicians immediately jump on it and begin to attack the laboratory for, its supposed laxness and endangering of the community. The laboratory, meanwhile, sets out to determine to figure out what's causing the leak. Then, at the beginning of May, the Department of Energy fires the contractor, the manager of the laboratory, called Associated Universities Incorporated. This is a group that's designed to run the laboratory, sort of like a university environment. And but instead, that firing, instead of calming the public, created more fear, because basically it was saying the Department of Energy thought that the leak was very dangerous, because they wouldn't have done this without people thought without there being a serious danger. And then in the summer, summer afterwards, this is summer of 1997, crazy things happen. And that is what I think is, one of the bizarre, these are the bizarre pieces of the story that I couldn't believe at the time. One of them was at a tritium, a pool of tritium was discovered, near the reactor. At a 10 days after the firing of the contractor, a New Jersey teenager, after prom, got a little drunk, went to a landfill, discovered one of these exit signs. Remember, I told you the tritium is in self-eliminating exit signs, broke it open and wound up ingesting some tritium.
Oh, no.
Then he looked at, then he saw the radioactive sign on it. He got terrified, went to his doctor. The doctor examined him, and his pee contained a higher concentration of tritium than the plume itself. But then the doctor said, but it's safe. Go home, drink lots of water, and pee it out. And the doctor said, I didn't talk to that doctor, but another doctor who was working on it said that normally they'd tell the person to drink beer and pee it out, but this kid was underage. So but the doctor was right. It was the teenager was not in danger. So here you have, you know, you have an incredible irony that if you read this in a story, you wouldn't believe it, that you have a manager of a laboratory fired for a leak, but then a teenager drinking tritium at the same time, but it being completely safe. So that was one of the ironies of the story. Oh, but by the way, I should say too that 1997, I forgot to mention, this was the 50th year of Brookhaven. So, you know, the lab was on the verge of celebrating its 50th anniversary, half century of existence, during which time its work had been awarded 4 Nobel Prizes. And then this catastrophe happens. It turned into a chaotic period in which one of its major instruments was shut down. So I guess I've taken the story to the summer of 1997. Is that, should I go farther than that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so the summer of 1997, an anti-nuclear activist group forms whose aim is to shut the reactor. And it's run by celebrities, including most notably Alec Baldwin and a little bit later Christie Brinkley. And so they join this attempt to shut the reactor. In the fall, in September, the two politicians, Alphonse D'Amato and Michael Forbes, introduced legislation to terminate the reactor completely. And the eventually in 2.5 years later, the reactor is terminated completely. And so this book, I mean, just to summarize this 300, I can't really summarize this 300 page book. It's full of these incredible events that you can't believe. Eventually the reactor is terminated, and it's terminated by the Department of Energy secretary without telling the lab. So the lab is constantly ambushed by these by events, and at the end by the closure of the reactor without telling the lab. Everyone learned about it from the newspapers.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
So why did it all happen this way? Did it have to happen this way?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I still wonder. Mm-hmm. In a sense, it did, because everyone was acting the way they knew how to act. The scientists were, you know, they thought that the numbers showed that this wasn't dangerous. So, and when they explained to the public, they explained things very cautiously and with error bars. The activists were said things very dramatically and set up, you know, very colorful protests, made for TV protests that with dressed up as mushroom clouds and so on. Politicians were, you know, listened to the public, listened to their voters, and made decisions based on what they thought their voters wanted and their own political ambitions. The people in Washington, the Department of Energy bureaucrats, made decisions based on, you know, what they thought was the best welfare of the entire national laboratory system. So in a way, everyone played the game as well as they could, the way that they knew how. And what I think the point of the book is, do we want things to happen this way? Do we want our important decisions about health and safety and the environment to be made in the way that they were in 1997, 1998? And I think the answer is obviously no, and that we should think about doing things otherwise. That is, you know, if you ask, should the reactor have been terminated? I don't know the answer to that. We decide, countries decide to build scientific instruments based on their judgment about what kind of science they want and what kind of risks they're willing to incur. So I can't really judge as to whether it was a wise decision to close the reactor. But I do know from the events that the way the decision was made was not wise. The way that just from celebrity influence, political ambition, newspaper headlines, the way it was made, I don't want decisions to be made about my health and safety the way they were made in this case.
And our listeners will find more details about all of these events in your book, of course. So let's talk a little bit about the consequences and perhaps legacy of this event. So you already mentioned that it has impact on some of the controversies that we see today.
Well, there are several things. I mean, from a purely scientific standpoint, the consequences were bad in that there were very few neutron scattering facilities at the time. You need neutrons to study certain aspects of the structure of metal, say, or for to study, you know, to image biological samples and so forth. You also need neutrons to make radioisotopes, because isotopes are important for medical diagnosis and medical treatment. And with the neutron facilities dwindling, and the HFBR was the principal source of them at the time, the American programs in neutron science were severely hurt, and people began to go to Europe, where there's a reactor in Grenoble, the Institut Laue Langevin. They have a new neutron scattering facility. So it hurt the American science program, but it also, as I said, was the canary in the coal mine for things that are happening today. And I think you can see, oh, wait a minute, I should mention something else. After this, after the Associated Universities was fired as the manager of Brookhaven, the Department of Energy changed its contracting system to encourage the managers to be more bureaucratic. So the character of the way science is practiced at the national laboratories changed after that. And the Brookhaven concept, the fallout literally from, well, no, not literally, sorry, metaphorically from Brookhaven was to change the character of the working atmosphere in national laboratories. But then, as I said, the main thing that fascinated me from the beginning was that this was the canary in the coal mine for a lot of the things, a lot of the episodes of science denial from global anti-global warming people, the anti-vaxxers and so forth. All the techniques you see there were practiced at Brookhaven 25 years ago. So this is kind of a little ocular into what's happening now.
So was it a matter of lack of communication that, for example, today we can have everything in our smartphones right away, you know, if something's happening? But in those days, as you said, you had to wait for the headlines and look through the newspapers.
Well, you know, if you turn the book over and look at the back, there's a quote from the president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, Marsha McNutt, who says, if you think that the successful spread of misinformation is due to social media, think again. Because basically this is what happened then. If you looked at headlines, served just as well in those days. If you learned about what was happening at the lab just from headlines, you had no reason not to think that the laboratory was dangerous. I mean, I ran into somebody who actually has read the book, who I didn't know. And he said, you know, he grew up on Long Island and he just assumed the laboratory was a very dangerous place. And then he read my book and he saw all of the episodes happening, and he realized that it wasn't the way that he thought it was, but he understood why he got that impression. So I forgot what your question was.
The communication.
Communication. Right. That's an important question too. What would have, and it connects to something you said before, which is, you know, what could have prevented it? But I don't think it was just communication. You know, people think, oh, let's have scientists be better communicators of their work. I mean, you might have gone through things. You're a grad student in neuroscience, right?
Mm-hmm.
You may have taken courses in how to explain your work to the public. I mean, at Stony Brook here, we have a special Alan Alda Center to teach scientists to explain their work to the public. But this didn't quite work at Brookhaven. And the reason it didn't work is because of everything else, all the other surrounding episodes and things that were happening and the distrust that was being cultivated by the activists and the politicians. A good science communicator, you know, they would have been tarred. People would have said, oh, but you're from the laboratory. What you said is false. So I don't think it's just communication, and it's easy to say, oh, just educate people better. But, you know, I don't think education works either. It's the whole climate that produced what has happened. Like, it's the whole climate today that produced what is happening. I mean, if someone, you must have seen or read a climate scientist explaining carefully why they think what they do, but they're completely ignored by people who are opposed to them. Vaxxers as well too, you know, and they're, you know, Fauci was a great explainer, but he was, there are people who don't believe him. So, one more element that I should mention, I forgot to mention, was that one of the bad things that happens when you have conspiracy theories floating around, major conspiracy theories, is that you have to undermine the authority. You have to undermine trust in reputable institutions whose aim is to protect you. So, you know, if you really don't believe in global warming, you have to distrust all of those institutions that say there is global warming. If you don't trust vaccines, then you have to distrust the EPA and other people who tell you that the vaccines work. And similarly, there was these conspiracy theories that floated around on Long Island. In order to work, they had to cast distrust on the local organizations whose job it was to protect the groundwater. So the Suffolk, for instance, the Suffolk County Water Authority. And the Suffolk County Water Authority knew that the local water was good, it was drinkable, it was pure, but they were being tarred by the activists who said that, they must be wrong. And the local water authority ran newspaper ads, were forced to run newspaper ads saying, no, the water's safe. You may have heard that there's pollution in the water. That's not true. The water is safe. So that's one of the collateral damages of conspiracy theories, is that you have to cast distrust on trustworthy organizations.
Well, for sure. And to debunk something, you have to do it in 10 times more resources being allocated to that.
Exactly. You have to debunk people, and you have to debunk very reputable people in order to maintain your conspiracy theory.
So has there been something that good that came out of it? Maybe policy changes or more control overlook? You already mentioned about the managerial structure.
Mm-hmm. There were one good thing was that the laboratory, the new manager of the laboratory, initiated a dialogue forum between the laboratory and various communities around, called the Citizens Community Advisory Council. And they bring together a whole range of people, from activists to, you know, people support the lab and so forth. And they meet monthly, and they talk through issues. That was a very, very positive thing. And it should have happened to the laboratory. Well, I guess it should have happened at the beginning. But that's one very, very positive thing. And the other is that it's caused us to think about how to care for large scientific facilities. You know, you have to care about the community reception of them, you know, not just build these wonderful state-of-the-art scientific facilities. You have to think about how it will be received by the communities around you.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't just put it there and just look at it. You have to maintain it and everything like that.
Exactly. You can't just slap it slap it down and expect that it will be well received.
So you just described absolutely crucial point that, you know, in these kind of events, it's never just one thing, like communication, for example. There's a lot going on, like agendas of different parties and politicians and perhaps public and media. And is there a way to actually tackle these kinds of events well, if there's just so many different moving parts?
You know, that's a very interesting question. In a way, that's the book. That's the point that the book points towards. I mean, at the end of the book, well, all throughout the research, I would ask people, "What went wrong? How could we do this better?" And maybe I asked, you know, 24 people, and Galina, I got 24 different answers. And I put them, many of them, at the end of the book. So one person said, look, you can't, if you're doing nuclear research, you can't fly below the radar. You have to explain to the public what you're doing and the risks. Because then if there's a blip, if you have an accident, then you don't have any capital in order to be able to address what's happening. Another person said, trusting relationships. Martha Krebs, who was in the Department of Energy at the time, said the key was trusting relationships. If you don't have trusting relationships, then it's not going to happen. Another person, Ernie Moniz, who was also in the Department of Energy, said politicians. If your politicians aren't in, if you want to do something major and the department, your local politicians aren't behind you, then you haven't done your homework. So there was a whole set of different kinds of responses, which is what was interesting. You know, that was something that was fascinating to me. But, you know, in a way, the most interesting comment was by the person who took over directing the laboratory at the end, called John Marburger. And he said, you know, it's what happened at Brookhaven was sort of like a catastrophe in the engineering sense of the word, and which is that, you know, a catastrophe in that sense is when you have a machine that's running, a complex machine, but it grows out of sync with the environment, so that all it takes is one tiny thing to go wrong and the whole machine stops or breaks down. And so it's like a relationship. If you know, you might have had friends who go, oh, we broke up because that person, they forgot to mail a letter. Well, you know, does the letter bring the relationship to a halt? And in fact, it's not just the letter, it's the whole, you know, relationship itself. Well, in Brookhaven, it was the relationship between the lab and the environment, where it had grown out of sync, and all it took was one thing, this leak, this non-hazardous leak, which leads to this huge breakdown. So the answer to your question, you know, I know it's you're going to be unhappy with this response, but you know, there's no single tweak that you can give. There's no single thing that you can point to. You know, oh, communications or politicians or trust or that sort of thing. It's you have to pay attention to the whole connection between the facility and the environment. And that I think is the lesson of the book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely love this match of metaphor. It kind of really puts everything in place for me. Like looking at those engineering diagrams about failure, you know, because that's
Yeah.
something that can happen very, very rarely, but has catastrophic events and pretty much impossible to prevent.
Yeah.
So, what discoveries in your research for the book, The League, surprised you the most?
You know, what surprised me the most was that there were parts that were funny. Everyone once in a while, I'd come across these things that were happening, and they make me laugh, and they made people at the time laugh. So that was that was part of the delightful thing, elements in my research.
And have you visited the laboratory yourself?
Not well, as I said, at the time I was there and I saw many of these protests, and I talked to a lot of people, but recently, since the pandemic, I haven't been there. No.
Excellent. Well, this has been a really fascinating and very insightful talk. So, can you tell us what are you focusing on now and what will be your next project?
Well, as I said, the thing that attracted me to philosophy of science was that this question about what about the relation of scientific facilities and scientific authority and the surrounding communities. What kind of authority does science have? Should it be incorporated directly into government, or how should it be adjusted? Things like this episode that happened at Brookhaven showed that it's a very poorly understood but highly important aspect of science to study the relation between science and the communities. So here I wrote this book about one episode. I'd like to write a book about, in general, the relationship between well, what I was explaining to you is the complex nature of the relationship between scientific facilities and the surrounding communities.
And what's the best way for our listeners to find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, Googling is a good place to start. I have a lot of books on books published, although this is the one I like the most, or right now. And I'm actually revising my website. It's robertpcrease.com. If you go there, right now, Galina, you'll see that it says, site under construction. But maybe today or tomorrow, I hope to be able to make it go live.
Okay, great. Gonna check. Okay, so is there any last message that you would like to leave our listeners with?
Last message, I think, is that this is a very important, the relation between science and society, I think, is the well, let me go on a limb, out on a limb and say it's the most important issue today. The major existential questions that humanity faces all involve the relationship, at one point, the relationship between science and society. Global warming, what is it? How do we believe it? How do we respond to it? These are questions that involve the relation between science and society. Pandemics, obviously, we've seen that as well too. So I think this is the most important scientific, this is the most important social issue that we face, which is how society digests science and scientific authority.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Galena. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the book.